you know your baby boy will one day walk on water? Mary, did you know your baby boy will save our sons and daughters? Did you know your baby boy has come to make you new? This child that you delivered will soon deliver you. Mary, did you know your baby boy will give sight to a blind man? Mary, did you know your baby boy will calm a storm with his hand? Did you know your baby boy?
Welcome.
Good evening.
This is, welcome. Go ahead. This is Joseph Hardy Presents. We're so happy to be back on the air with everybody. And I'd like to turn this over to Diane Wadigo, my co-producer. Go ahead, Diane.
Hi, we have a great show for you tonight. And as Joseph said, and says, we are blessed to do our broadcast on Easter Sunday. Our first guest is Ned. Ned, how do you say your last name?
Amatania.
Thank you. In 2013, he created the first and largest near-death experiences group on Facebook. Please tell us more. Go ahead, Ned.
Sure. Back then, I was really interested in not only learning about the near-death experiences, but also sharing them with everyone. And at that time, I started out a group on Facebook, and it's simply called Near-Death Experiences. And today, it has almost 200,000 members, and I think it's a testament to the interest that people have in this topic. We haven't had to do any advertising or anything. It's just a lot of people are finding the group and the conversations, and they're asking questions about, you know, what happens when I die, or do I have to be afraid of hell, or so many questions. I created it on September 15th, 2013, and I consciously made it public. There are private groups on Facebook, and so you can only join if you've had a near-death experience, but I intentionally made this group a public, open group because I want the message to get out to the world and anyone curious. And so it has been a labor of love for 11 years now.
You know, Ned, when I first started doing this, which is 20-some years ago now, I think, if you talk to someone about near-death experience, I thought you were nuts. And so people were really... I'm so happy that finally it's come around and people are really now understanding about this. So I'm so happy you're doing this, Ned.
Thank you. I actually feel, especially since today is Easter, and happy Easter, everyone. But the whole message of the rising of a Christ consciousness is so important, and we see that in the example of Jesus, but also just in humanity. Like, what I think about the importance of near-death experiences is that it's fostering a Christ consciousness in humanity, because for so long, up until the 60s, 70s, 80s, and whatnot, when people had these experiences, oftentimes they had to keep quiet about them, because otherwise they could end up in an asylum or an institution. Yeah. And I think finally enough people are saying, hey, look, spirit is actually real. And also, it isn't only spirit and the afterlife, but it's also the importance of that kindness and unconditional love. Everything that Jesus taught about loving ourselves and our neighbors, even our enemies, when people have these experiences and come back, they are often transformed, and they realize that it's not about materialism or just the endless rat race and accumulating our bank accounts. It's about supporting each other. And I wanted to add, a lot of people are struggling, especially because at least here in the U.S. with the economy, a lot of people are paying a rent or mortgages, and it's hard. And people are wondering, is there a greater purpose? Why am I here? You know, is it, a lot of people, even people who go to church or intellectual people who are not interested in religion at all, will often feel, you know, why am I here? And I used to be like that. I used to be an atheist, and it was when I found near-death experiences, it was like there is a purpose here. And so as hopeless or as mundane as my life often felt, it's almost like the near-death experience is a guiding light towards what we're all kind of nudged and called to do more of here on Earth.
That's exactly right.
Do you have any particular direction or question? Or if not, I can keep on.
Well, I just wanted to say that Corporal or Diane, you there?
Yes.
I was going to say, Diane, she's a colonel, Diane, and she is a retired nurse, and she's got, you probably know her, Ned.
Yeah.
She has said for years, because she was a nurse, and she brought people when Vietnam was happening, and she'd bring guys off of the field who were, you know, who were wounded and stuff, and so many of them said they had a near-death experience, didn't know what it was. And she's always been saying that she thinks that a lot of people who have them and don't know what they are causes post-traumatic stress. And I must have sure you're not right about that.
I've heard that. And also, it's important because if anyone listening is in the military or is a veteran, it's such a taboo or secret subject in the military, especially if anyone has PTSD or have had a near-death experience, they don't want to hear about it. And so my group and other groups like it are so important, because a lot of people can only ever connect to other people who've had the similar experience. A lot of times, if a person has an NDE and they tell their doctor or their spouse or family, a lot of people are not interested in hearing it.
Diane Goble, who's going to be on, we thought tonight, her and her husband got divorced over this, because she had a near-death experience and her husband was there, and she was a different person for years and years and years, and he got divorced because he just didn't believe or what she went through, and so they got separated. So you're right about that.
And it's unfortunate, but also I think, like, overall, like, this evolution of humanity, like, remember how everyone talked about 2012, and it was, you know, they talked about it would be like a magical shift. And I don't think, you know, as we saw, that didn't exactly happen, but I think it's just a larger, it's like a marker or a milestone in terms of we are slowly shifting, especially since, you know, now a lot of people, if they're in the hospital and they've had were in a coma or had a near-death experience, can actually talk about it. And the worst that can happen is people, you know, dismiss it. But now a lot of people, they know and they've heard about these, like, in TV, in movies, or in groups where it's like, oh, I've heard of that. And so I kind of have an understanding of what that is. My biggest passion is telling the world, anyone who will listen, these are real, and there is medical evidence. It's in the records. It's in the, it's called veridical perception, where the people accurately observe what's happening around them, or even at far distances. And this is interesting because it gets into the topics of, like, telepathy, or, you know, in quantum physics, we talk about entanglement. It's where time and distance don't matter. It's a direct connection. And a lot of people, in their experiences, they talk about leaving their physical body and then traveling, either in the cosmos, you know, out in the universe, and oftentimes wherever they put their thoughts or mind, they instantly travel there. And so I'm like a scientist at heart. I'm a software engineer as my day job, and I've always had a mind that asks, how does everything work? I'm not interested in just ideas or beliefs or fairy tales or opinions. I want the evidence, and the evidence actually led me here to near-death experiences. And so, and something about Easter, like when you think about Easter as the rising and the rebirth of the Christ consciousness, what is that that people talk about? It's a consciousness of a very high vibration, unconditional love for everyone, and it's also powerful. And in our religious figures, in Jesus, when people often actually meet him in their experiences, we are also the children of God, or of Source. We are beings, and we have this energy within us. And a lot of people, when they come back or they have these experiences and are told it's not your time, you have to go back to Earth because you still have a mission. And what that mission is often, it has to do with expressing our heart, expressing our passions. And for me, this is my passion. Even though for so long I have been shy, I have been afraid of speaking up, but it's like, but I feel in my heart like, this is why I'm here. Even there's a whole story. I think we're out of time, but when I was in high school, I thought about suicide because I didn't see a purpose mm-hmm. here on Earth. But there is a purpose.
Every one of us have a purpose. You bet. We all. I said this all my life. We all have a story, and that story is, you know, we end up sometimes we find out and. When we're younger, sometimes it takes, you know, a long time to find out what the story is. But gosh, I'm so happy that you're here with us, and I'm so happy that we're going to talk lots about this, Ned. I think that We're very lucky to have you with us. And so what do you think, Diane?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful thing to find out what your purpose is, because then you feel so fulfilled. But is Diane Goble here?
No, I don't think she made it.
Mm.
So,
well, Kelvin is here.
Yeah. Yep, I'm here.
Okay, so what's your take on what Ned's talking about?
My take on what Ned's talking about? Well, you know my background. I mean, those people in the audience probably don't know who I am, but my memories on the other side, I've had thousands of experiences on the other side. I almost drowned when I was 21, and when I was in 1977, my past life memories started opening up, and so for the last 50 years, I have memories of a couple of dozen lifetimes that reach back 6,000 years, some of which were in the time of Jesus, with Jesus, etc. And then in the mid-1980s, I spontaneously opened up to the other side, so I've been communicating with beings in the other side, dead loved ones, people I know, people I don't know, beings, other beings, angels, et cetera, et cetera, for whatever the math is, since 1986. So all of it's very real. What Ned's talking about is real from my personal experience anyway, and from the thousands of clients who I have in 68 countries now around the world. So that's the short answer.
So you wrote three books, and
right.
and you also teach meditation.
Right, I've been teaching meditation for over 50 years. So, yeah. So, dovetailing onto something that Ned talked about, the military and so forth. I taught the very first meditation courses in the history of West Point Military Academy in New York. The U.S. Army Military Academy, 1974. I learned to meditate in 1970, studied personally with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in 1971 and 73. So I learned TM at first, mainly because I was very stressed out. I did not know anything about spiritual stuff. I did not believe in reincarnation, did not believe in heaven and the afterlife or whatever you want to call it. I was very anxious. I was 19 years old. I was a teenager, and that's why I learned. I was a test subject in the very first medical studies ever done in the United States on any kind of meditation in 1970, 71. They took blood samples, et cetera, all kinds of stuff. They did, blood panels and researched many, 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 eventually hundreds and hundreds of different parameters that the meditation was affecting in our neuropsychology and neurophysiology, etc. But I taught the meditation courses at West Point, and then shortly after that, when I got out of graduate school at Yale, I was asked to teach in the U.S. Army, and I taught on all the U.S. Army bases in 1974, wow. 1975 in Korea, including on the demilitarized zone. And then
wow.
The U.S. Air Force invited me in, and I taught on all the Air Force bases in Korea. So,
well, you know,
when I was in my 20s.
People who do this I actually did this for years, and what I found out was when you focused your mind on meditation, or however you get all your thoughts together and you do this a couple minutes, 5 minutes a day, it's funny that everything you could ever want or before you want it comes to you.
Yeah, the way I teach it, I give Maharishi credit for being the guy, and I think he'll be known historically. Even I've left the organization after about 10 years in the late 70s, early 80s, when they went off in other directions, and I stayed focused on teaching the meditation. But I call what I teach now turning within meditation is what I call
uh-huh.
what I teach. And I've removed all the cultural. You and I have talked about this, Joseph. I've removed all the cultural trappings so I can teach meditation in schools and businesses and so forth in a way that's secular. It's not religious and not cultural.
I've made it easier. Well, we have a job ahead of us, you and I, because I'm going to work very hard to get meditation back into schools, because people commit suicide because you're bullied.
Yes. It's terrible.
And I think if we were allowed to do this, I did talk with the school district at one time, and they said, yes, I would love to have you do this. And then he never followed through with it. And so I think we just have to beat that drum until he finally say, okay, let's try it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Kind of.
Yeah.
And so
I teach kids starting at 4 years old, Joseph, years old. And around 8 or 9 or 10 years old, they start doing it with their eyes closed. Just for a few minutes, they don't do it as long as the adults do it, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're kids. But it's very, very easy for them to learn. There's no focusing. You're not focusing on the breath. You're not concentrating. You're not controlling it. You're not trying to clear your mind of thoughts. It's a very different process from most of the meditation techniques out there. And I've taught so many kids and teenagers, especially the teenagers you're talking about are, like you say, they go through a lot of hormonal and brain development changes just naturally, and some of that causes a great deal of stress and anxiety on their psychology. So that, like you say, the suicide level is very challenging. Let's just say from 16 to 20 years old. You know.
Well, let me tell you what happened. My grandson, as you probably know, I was in Beverly Hills doing Academy Award and Gold Globe flowers. And really, I've been doing it for 60 years. And so I made a name for myself. I did flowers for the movie stars and all that stuff. But so when I came home back to Olympia, my grandson asked me if I would give a talk at high school. And of course, I was flattered to do that because, I have so much to share. And so, of course, I got enough carnations to do to teach them all how to make a lathe. And and so, of course, the principal came in and she said to me, I've never heard these guys so quiet. You should do this for a living. And they gave me a grant, and I actually taught special ed for a year. And I could have continued until they built a new school, so our funding was cut. But I'll tell you, it was the best time of my life. And what I want to tell you is that we talked about meditation there, and we talked about different things. And I have a whole new respect of teachers since I was a teacher. I mean, they're unsung heroes. They're fathers, they're mothers, they're best friends. And you know, whether you have children who have just one father only. You have single, you have a parent that just is working to keep food on the table and the whole thing. And so there's no time to sit down and say, okay, how was your day? So when you come to school, the teacher does that. The teacher works with the kids. So that's why meditation is so important.
Yeah, and you know, I think I've told you that I've taught my kids when they were 4 years old, right? And my daughter is 29 years old now, and she's teaching meditation now under my nonprofit as well. So she'd be ideal in terms of, you know, both of us. But her, you know, she's 29 and, you know, young and vibrant and at the age of the kids almost, you know. My son is 35, and, you know, these guys, they've been meditating for so long, and it's, like you say, it's helped them their entire life. That's the thing.
Well, you know, I'm like Ned, you know, I was an atheist. I feared death. I would drive around the cemetery. I just was so, and all of a sudden it was dumped on my lap. And I met this man at a dance recital where my daughters were both taking a dance recital. And he was there because he wanted to see what was going on with this whole thing. I sat next to him. And he had just come from Yogananda's ashram. And so I said to him, he was a monk there for a couple years. So he's telling me he taught meditation. And I said, hey, how about you doing a Sunday meditation for everybody? Reluctantly, he said, okay, I guess I can do that. And we had so many people there, Kevin, so many people that the nuns came. The priest and the nuns came, and they said, I haven't been as close to Jesus since I was in the seminary. I mean, it was it was phenomenal. Yeah. And the reason I bring this up is that the drug enforcement and the alcohol people at the base asked us to teach this to the people who were going through drugs and alcohol.
Well, that's actually what got me into the Army in the first place, was in the drug and alcohol rehab program.
Yeah,
that's where I got in. But I was teaching anybody. But to segue on what you were just talking about, clergy, I've taught priests, nuns, rabbis, imams, Buddhist monks. I've taught Buddhist monks what I teach. And I tell them it's not a conflict with what they're doing or they're praying. Talk Christian monks who are praying all day and so forth. I tell them to continue doing whatever they're doing. I respect what they're doing. And they just add what I teach because it's not religious and it's not cultural. And they add it to their own, in their case, their religious, day, their religious regimen and so forth. And it brings out, as you said, it brings out more of their own connection, in their case, with God or with Buddha or with whomever, with themselves from within. And that's why I call it turning within meditation now.
Yeah. And, you know, about the near-death experiences, I've talked to so many people who wasn't into any religion. When they came back, they wanted to spread the word and say, you have no idea. A good example is Dr. Melvin Morris. You know him. I'm sure you do. I had him on my show, and he was saying that he was he's the brain specialist, and he was in charge of University of Washington Pediatric. And he was telling me on my radio show that, first of all, I met him. I did his flowers for his wedding. And then when I would deliver the flowers in July, it was so hot that I said, let's put them in a garage. And I got there early. And when she rolled the garage door up, there was 3,000 books that he had written and signed them. And so I said, what's he write about? And she said, death and dying. That's all I had to hear. And that was when Oprah Decorator went overseas with his partner, and they were in the hotel room, and a tsunami came and took them both out to sea, and he never saw his partner again. And so he was crying. So I sent a book to him, and Oprah called Dr. Morris about a week later and said, come to my show. So Dr. Morris was on Oprah's show twice, Larry King twice, 2020, and Discovery Channel. So he always says, thank you, Joseph. I said, I have nothing to do with that. You're a brilliant man, and I appreciate you, but I just want to tell you a quick story. He was off duty this day, and he was in San Francisco, and somebody had pushed this young girl. She was 9 years old in the water. She was underwater for, I think, 19 minutes, maybe.
Wow.
And so he was called in, and so he intubated her. He taped her eyes closed. He put a tube down her throat, and he worked on her for an hour. And so he brought her back, of course, but it was a long, long time. And so he's doing his rounds. He's walking through the hall, and the girl has her parents walking, and she saw him, and she said to her parents, there's a guy who put a tube up my nose. And he goes, what are you trying to do to me anyway? I was pretty upset with you. I couldn't get back into my body, she said. I was standing next to my body. I couldn't get back into it.
But she was aware of everything that he did.
Oh, aware of everything. And so he said, can we talk in my office tomorrow? So she told the whole story about her watching everything and watching him say, put his hands, had his head in his hands and saying, gee, I hope I can save her. So then a woman came, not an angel, named Elizabeth, and she took her by the hand and said, come on, I'll help you. And she took her through the tunnel. And when she got through the tunnel to paradise, she saw her grandmother there, who had passed away earlier, and her dog jumped in her lap and licked her all over. She was so happy. And then she sat in Jesus' lap.
Right.
So then Elizabeth said, "Do you want to go home?" And the funny part about near-death experiences, when you get there, you don't want to come back. You want to stay there.
Well, it depends. It depends on the person. I actually have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clients who've had that many experiences, and some of them I have clients who've had multiple NDEs. If you believe that, I had one client who had four near-death experiences.
Wow.
And so it varies. It varies. Sometimes people want to come right back. Some people don't. Some people, you know, like you say, sit on Jesus' lap. Some are sitting on Muhammad's lap. Some are sitting on their dead grandmother's lap. It depends on the filter. It depends
exactly
on the filter of the person.
Everything is different.
That's
I know that.
It's filthy.
Anyway,
yeah.
So Elizabeth opened up a porthole, and she said, "Your mother, you have to go back. Your mother is going to have a baby. It's going to be a baby boy, and it's going to have a heart problem. You have to go home and take care of it." So at that instant, she went back to her body, and she went through the whole thing. And so we had a station break, and so we all said, when they would come back on the air, we went, "What happened?" And we said, "Did she have a baby?" "Yes." "It was a baby boy." "Yes." Did it have a heart problem?" He said, "Yes." And it was 2 years after that little meeting. So the girl now is 11 or 12. So anyway.
Yeah. So the way I look at those experiences, Joseph, is we can see probabilities. There's no guarantees. But there are probabilities, and whoever told her that on the other side probably could see the probability because they could see the DNA, they could see the biological structure, and they could see that something was going to happen. And so that's what increased the probability that they were right, and then they were right. So, things can be foreseen to a degree is my experience. The other thing I want to mention is, I talk about in my first book on overcoming the fear of death, a number of NDEs, and one of them, a friend of mine, Jay Peters, died for 20 minutes in a hospital, and he was wired up, all hooked up to machines, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all documented. I've had dinner with one of the doctors. There were 8-10 doctors and nurses in the room, and I've met with one of the doctors and talked. So I know it happened, and I know for how long it happened. So that's very unusual for people who don't know. 4 to 6 minutes, that's usually the maximum, with no oxygen, no brain activity, no nothing, and you're quote-unquote dead. Well, my friend Jay came back after 20 minutes, no brain damage, no neuromuscular issues, and all of his allergies that he's had since 11 years old, this happened when he was 54 years old, had disappeared. The other thing I want to mention in terms of the meditation that we were talking about, Joseph, is when people experience the fact through meditation, naturally start gradually experiencing that their mind and their body are in fact separate and distinct from each other, that starts to create a bridge. A bridge between what? A bridge between this side and the other side, whether they realize it or not.
I didn't believe it.
But it's not about belief. It's not about belief. Experientially, you start experiencing that distinction between the biological body and, you can call it, mind, soul, spirit, consciousness, whatever you want to call it. Synonymous, right? That's the interesting thing about a meditation process that's very easy to do, because the easier it is, the faster and more effective you're going to be at.
And they're all winging up there. They want communication with us. You know, they want us to know that they're great, they're fine. I had a situation where a woman, I did flowers for a woman, and I know that she lost her son in a war that was recent, like a year or so. military die. And she, I sent flowers to her from somebody. And so I wasn't able to talk to her at the time. So the next day she calls me back and she says, my flowers died. And I went, gee, I haven't had flowers die in my entire life, but I'll get you some more. So I did. I had bought them at Fred Meyer, and they must have been old. So anyway, I got a new flower bouquet. And she said to me, that's more like it. You're beautiful. So then I said, how are you? And she said, well, I'm not doing very well. My son's memorial service is tomorrow. I don't want to go. And I said to her, you know, and I believe this with all my heart, they see us, they hear us, they know exactly what's going on with us.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I know that's true. And so I said to her, you know, this is not for him, it's for you. This service is for you. He's fine. He's in heaven, and he sees you. He knows. He doesn't want you to be unhappy, but this is not for him. It's for you. So I said, if I were you, I would go. So she went, and the next day she called me. She went, you have no idea how I need to hear that. And that's what I do and have done now for the last 15 years in my flower shop. But I do 7 to 8 funerals a week, and I'm able to talk about people like that and say, you know, life goes on.
Exactly. It's a beautiful thing you're doing. It's a beautiful thing you're doing, Joseph, because it helps reduce people's fears, and that's the work of
Ned, the same thing. Ned says the same thing. If we could just get people to understand that this is not, this is like going into a different room.
Yeah.
It's
right here.
Exactly.
Right here.
It's right here.
You just can't see it. That's what I tell people. People look up in the sky and they think, that's because of paintings and movies and stuff.
Yeah,
Heaven's not up in the sky. The other side is right here. Most people can't see. Now, I can see into it sometimes.
So that's
the thing. It's not, you're not going any place that's far away. It's we lose our biological body and our mind continues. That's the thing.
And I don't know if you remember, Sharon Milliman, do you remember her?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, she told the story about her getting struck by lightning and going to heaven. And one of the things that I really remember about her is that she lost two twin brothers when they were like 5 in a car crash, I believe. And so when she had we all have a life review, you know that, right? So
you can if you want to, yeah. You can have a life review if you want.
People I've talked about, all had one. So she had a life review, and she was standing there. Usually your guides or your angels are next to you for support. So there was these two, she said, strapping, handsome, 6'5", who she thought was angels. And Dad said, Sharon, don't you recognize us? And she said, well, kind of, we're your brothers. So what I've learned from this is you grow up in heaven when you lose the baby.
It's not so much that you grow up, because you're not biological on the other side. It's more you're energetic. Therefore, you can make yourself appear in whatever form you want. So what they did was their soul, their spirit, their consciousness projected in her view them when they're 6'5". I've had experiences with Maharishi since he died. I knew him in the 1970s. As I said, I left the organization in the late 70s, early 1980s, because they went off in different directions, et cetera. I knew him when he was in his 50s. I did not know him when he was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, or 90s, when he died when he was 90-something years old. But so he came, how does he appear to me? He has appeared to me when I knew him in the 1970s, when he was in his 50s. So you can do that. I've had that experience with a number of people I knew in the 20th and 21st century who have died. They can appear in whatever way they want. So their biology doesn't exist on the other side, but they can project themselves just like they did to her. Yeah, it's interesting, right?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
So do you want to talk about meditation?
Sure. So what do you want me to talk about? Which aspect?
To maybe learn how learn that it's not so hard to do, and maybe you could get.
Yes, it's not so hard to do. That's the big misunderstanding, is that it's not difficult. It should not be difficult to meditate. As you know, and you need to take my class, Joseph. Seriously,
You could take it for free.
It's a 4-day class. It's a couple hours each day, and then you've learned it. But it's more than just, you know, I'm going to teach somebody. You tell me when we're getting near the end of the show, and I'm going to teach somebody, the people on the audience here, a simple technique that will help center them and so forth. But it's not a meditation technique. But I'll teach them. You just give me a heads up. Take me a minute to teach them. But the meditation technique that I teach is very easy. Should not involve any concentration, not clearing the mind, etc. Anybody who's ever tried to clear their mind knows that it's impossible to do.
It's difficult because
what does the mind want to do? It wants to think other stuff. So instead of resisting and fighting the natural tendency of the mind, instead what we can do, and I teach people to do, is to go with the natural tendency of the mind to wander. And then overlap on top of that a specific technique that does not involve focusing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where the rubber meets the road.
That makes sense.
10 to 15 minutes each time. You don't have to do it for hours. 10 to 15 minutes each time. And I even make it more flexible than that with my students.
Great.
10 to 15 minutes twice a day. That's it.
So let me have a conversation with Diane for a minute, and also Ned, and then we'll get back to you, and we'll have you do it the last couple minutes.
Sure.
So, Diana, tell us what you do. Diane, are you there? Ned, are you there? Can you hear me?
Well, you and I can talk.
I don't know why they hung up. I mean, Diane doesn't.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, anyway. Yeah, so, well, you know, I'm so happy that we finally got you on the show. We've been talking about it for a long time. We did have you on, but you didn't have very much time to talk, so that's great.
So
tell me about the first book you wrote.
The first book is Overcoming the Fear of Death, is what it's called. Overcoming the Fear of Death.
That's important.
It's very important, as you and Ned referenced earlier as well, about reducing fears about death and dying. And as he said, I agree with him, the more we talk about this as a cult world culture, then the less fearful people will be about it. They need to share more of their experiences. I also help people with grief work, and in the grief groups that I'm involved in, I'm telling you, worldwide, it's somewhere close to 20-25% of the people who've had dead loved ones die have been visited by them, but they don't talk about it because, as Ned said earlier, people are afraid to talk about it because they don't want to be, you know, drugged up by a psychiatrist or, you know, thought to be crazy. But 20-25%, think about that. That's a significant population of the world, percentage of the population of the world, who's been had some sort of visitation from a dead loved one. And some of the friends I talk about in my first book, some of the cases I talk about in my first book, one of which is a friend of mine, a lawyer who I worked with in a law firm that I worked at years ago. And it was the only experience he had, Joseph, that was unusual, except it was clear that his 17-year-old brother, who died in a car accident, you know, came to visit my friend, and my friend told his younger brother to go visit their mother because she was so distraught. Obviously, she saw her 17-year-old son leave in the morning, and he was dead in the afternoon. And so she never saw him again. And so 2 days later, the mother called up my friend and said, "Your brother came and visited me, and it did to let me know he's okay." So, you know, without my friend telling the mom that he had that experience. So these things, and it was the only one he's ever had since then, and he's now 60 years old. This happened when he was 20. So 40 years, he's never had any other unusual experience like that in his entire life. There's a lot of people walking around who've had experiences like that, and they're not talking about it. And so anyway, my first book, Overcoming the Fear of Death, is a non-religious approach to helping people reduce their fears about death and dying. And I talk about four different belief systems that underlie all the religious and cultural beliefs out there. They're not religious or cultural beliefs, but they underlie them. And so I look through these four lenses. The science lens, that's the you know, the person who doesn't believe in an afterlife, right? Science. And then you have the second belief system is, I call it the fear of continued existence, where people are afraid of something that may happen or punishment on the other side. They're afraid about something. They do believe that they will continue, but they're afraid. The third belief system is no fear and believe in heaven, and maybe they're looking forward to it.
Are you
and then the fourth belief system is reincarnation.
Are you back,
reincarnation,
Diane?
Reincarnation is the fourth one.
Yes, they had us muted by accident.
Yeah.
There was some feedback. Someone's listening on a speakerphone, and it was causing a feedback loop. And it might be you, Joseph.
It is me.
Yeah, switching back and forth. But when other minds are against that, it causes a feedback loop, and it sounds all weird. So we had to mute lines in order to stop that. So forgive us.
That's okay. So I just wanted to talk with Diane for a second. And Ned, are you there?
Go ahead.
Really?
Oh, okay.
Wow. About that.
Also, I want to put in the commercial.
Yeah, I was going to say, how about if you do that now?
Okay. All right, this hour is brought to you by eCare Mortuary, located in Olympia and Hollis, Washington. It's available by phone. The number is 360-747-7761, and it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The office hours are appointment only. Arrangements can be made on the website at ecaremortuary.com, or you can come into either location for traditional arrangements. So there you go.
I want to say something about this. These people came to see me at my home, and I was so impressed with this couple. He's a military man, you know, and she worked for another big, huge conglomerate mortuary for years, and she decided that she didn't like the way it was going, so she was going to do it her way, which is, I mean, first of all, there's the best price out there. And second of all, I just heard them, they were talking about someone lost a cat, and they just went ahead and took care of it without having to charge them for anything. You know, they're pretty good hearts. And boy, you know, I like to have people who have good hearts to take care of my family. And I just want to say, people need to go and do this early on. They just don't wait till this last second before someone passes away. You need to go have to do a pre-plan. It's so much easier when the time comes and it's all done for you, just so you know. So that, I wanted to ask Ned, what'd you think about Kevin's spiel about meditation?
I thought it was really interesting and helpful, and I didn't have any idea of how much direct experience and exposure in terms of his clients and friends who also had near-death experiences and all kinds of out-of-body experiences. So I've heard, you know, from so many people how important or how powerful meditation is, and sometimes I do it, but I'm not a regular, but I feel like it could definitely help
well
myself.
Yeah, this guy, which you know now, I guess, is about one of the best ones there is out there, and I'm so happy it's involved with us now. And I, if I have my way, I'm going to set something up for the school district, because they can certainly do this. And I'll do a meeting with the supervisors, and we'll make this happen, because I think that we can save a lot of people who, you know, when I was doing a show, Diane and I were doing a show in KLAY, I had a couple, husband and wife, they were psychotherapists, and they told me that they, mother and dad, they had one child, and nobody knows what happened. He had dinner, he did my kids tonight, and the next morning I went to get him for school, and he hung himself. These people are professionals. They can look for the signs. They had not a clue what the problem was.
No.
So, it's really, really important that we, I've said this for a long time, guys who think they're gay at 12 years old or whatever, they just they have to realize that that's not a problem. They just have to realize that people are kind and you can't just set yourself up to fail. That's all. So, this has been great, guys. Kevin, you're a wonderful speaker, and I'm so happy we're involved with you. And Diane, tell people what you're about. Diane, are you there?
Yeah, now I am.
So, Diane and I go way back. We've been shows for 20 years, and she's my co-producer. And Diane is a medium, and Diane's been a medium for as long as I can remember. And she's good at it, and she has done stuff with me and for me. And I've had people all our shows. People call in. We won't do it today, because it's too late. But we will have people call in for both Ned and Diane to do readings if you guys like. I just feel it's important. Yeah?
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know. I do have someone who would like to talk about transference psychotherapy.
Okay.
Can you have a minute?
Sure.
Is that okay? Okay, hold on. Here you go.
Yeah, I really appreciated what was said. My name is Dick Hagan, and we've been trying to work on the very thing that the doctor was saying concerning opening up that element of the human psyche. Problematically, if you have a foundation or have had a foundation, even if it's in a background in religion or even from the standpoint of secular development where there's a standard of morality that's usually been brought along in the past, but fundamentally because of the nature of combat and warfare, you feel that your center is lost. And one of the things we've been trying to do is to get that reintroduced, because not all methods are just cognitive behavioral or behavioral therapy utilizing drugs and the like. And they're beginning to explore within groups and the like, the idea of, well, one of the things that I did at our local VA was make a suggestion about drumming circles. And the behavioralists bought it. But the point was, those people who have gone through experiences, they sometimes find that even in this world, things happen to them. I had a Saul of Tarsus moment one day in a little country church, and the circumstances is that the Holy Spirit came out of this back into the sanctuary and stopped me in the middle of a song. I, like you, had a good baritone voice at the time, and I was singing a song in the presence of Jehovah, and in the process, it stopped me right in the middle of the song, and I turned to the congregation. I said, I'm sorry, I can't finish this song. No sooner I had stepped down than I felt this presence put me down on my knees in front of the entire congregation. Now, I'm a rationalist, okay? My favorite patron saint would be St. Thomas. And in the process, I was down there weeping for about 3-4 minutes. The elder came running. The pastor came running. After about 4 minutes, it lifted off of me. And I went back. I managed the sound system for the little place. And they said, are you all right? And I said, I couldn't feel better. But I didn't know the cause. And when I was in a men's fellowship study group, we were reading James. And it said, Jesus chastises those he loves. I mean, God chastises those that he loves. Yeah. Well, I was an ex-trained infantryman. I had been in post-war Germany from age 4 and a half. My dad was a trial lawyer at Nuremberg and with the military tribunals. And so my whole background was, I knew about Dachau from front end to back end by age 5. So I've been carrying a lot of stuff around for well over, you know, a lifetime. But somehow things happened there at that particular moment, which changed me. And circumstantially, you can have that kind of thing happening. And it, transference psychotherapy just relies on the fact of the very thing that the doctor was speaking about, opening those avenues by which the individual is receptive to the other dimensions based upon whatever experiences they have had, whatever you do in terms of meditation that helps open that type of thing. And right now, because of the behavioral methodologies that come out of the field of psychology, so much of it acts as a deterrent to the opening of it. And it's amazing that, I have had personal miracles. I mean, when I'm on an operating table and I'm praying, and I said, before you nail me down to the iron cross, I said, do you mind if we have prayer? This one instance, the nurse and there was no priest around or anything, so we all joined hands. And afterwards, I find out that my anesthesiologist was a Palestinian. And I said, oh, really? He said, and guess where I'm from? I said, I don't know. And he said, I was born in Bethlehem.
Wow. Wow. Hey, and, Dick, we'll have you on the show. We'll have to have you on the show. I'll give you a whole half an hour, buddy. So I'm so
happy. Well, I just want you to know it also goes the other way around in the way people can be open to that sense of self that basically disengages that sense of, what do you want to call it, behavioral control of your own sense of who you think you are. I mean, I look at all these MAGA boys running around, and they're going crazy.
I just took the phone away from him.
Anyway, thank you so much, Dick. Anyway, so, Ned, this is... So what do you think, Ned?
About everything that you shared?
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty excited about this show today because of what we're doing, you know. So we've had some great feedback, and I'd like to continue on doing this. We're going to do it every other Sunday, guys. So I hope you have time to do it with us. So if you want to close by doing a meditation and try that for a little bit and get people excited about meditation.
Well, you wanted me to teach. I can teach them this thing that's not meditation, I said. So it's not a meditation technique, but
that's
I'll teach
fine.
Them.
That's
it'll
fine.
Take about a minute. Right?
Okay.
And so
okay.
This technique, I call it the belly button technique. All right? So what it'll do is it'll help center the person. And if people are anxious or feeling stressed out, I have clients who have panic attacks. They find me online. And very often they say the four words they say to me is, you're my last hope. So I've helped, as I said, people, thousands of people in 68 countries. And so I teach my higher anxiety students this, but this can also just be a centering technique too. It's very simple. All you do, you can do it sitting, standing, lying down, eyes open, eyes closed, doesn't matter. All you do is put your hand on your tummy, doesn't matter which one. That's what I call the belly button technique. Put a hand on your belly button, just rest it there, and then take some slow, deep breaths. That's all you do. Slow, deep breaths. You don't hyperventilate. You don't speed up your breathing. You don't breathe in any abnormal way other than just slowly deep breathing. That's it. And in the tummy. So while you're doing that, I'll explain why it works. It works because if you're freaking out and having an anxiety moment, where are you? You're all up in your head. And what's the worst thing to do, as we said earlier? The worst thing to do is to try to get yourself out of your head, to stop thinking what you're thinking. Because what does that do? It makes you think more about what you're thinking. If I tell you to not think of the word hippopotamus, now you can't stop thinking about it, right? It doesn't work. So when you put your hand in your tummy, what does it do? Your mind automatically goes to where your hand is. It goes to your tummy. It automatically takes your mind out of where it is and puts it somewhere else physically on your body. When you take the slow, deep breaths, what does that do? There's a neurophysiologic response there, and it's the vagus nerve, V-A-G-U-S. You can Google it, Wikipedia it later. It's the longest nerve in the human nervous system, the human body. It goes from the base of your brain stem. It goes to your lung, your kidneys, your stomach, your small intestine. Everywhere in your body is where that nerve goes. And when you take slow, deep breaths, it stimulates the vagus nerve, which calms everything down. So it's very really quick, but it's temporary. It's temporary. That's why I say it's not a meditation technique. It doesn't have the long-term effects that meditation does. But it'll center you. And the other aspect, I've taught little children, taught my son this before he went to kindergarten. I have lawyers sitting in partnership meetings. When they start to have a panic attack, they do this. Nobody knows what you're doing. You can do it in public place, private place. Nobody's paying attention to where your hand is. And you're taking slow, deep breaths, and your eyes are open even. Or you can do it at night. I have a doctor. I just taught a doctor. I didn't even know he was a doctor. He told me he was a doctor afterwards. I met him in a group, and I taught him on Zoom. And he told me the week later that he's been doing it every night. Now he's been able to sleep. Since his wife died, he has not been able to sleep. And now he does this every night before he goes to bed. And he's a doctor. He's an MD, physician. Wow. And he understood when I talked about the vagus nerve and all of that, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very simple technique, and you can do it for a few seconds or a few minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. You cannot OD on it, and it's very simple, but it's temporary. It's immediate, but temporary. There you go. Okay?
So, Kevin, I know that Kevin is back east, so this is, what time is it there now?
Oh, it's 1 o'clock, 1:03 right now.
I shouldn't have asked you, huh?
That's all right.
God bless you for being with us. And I think I'd like to have you come next time, next week, not next Sunday, but the following Sunday, to continue this, if you would.
Okay, we'll talk about that. We'll schedule that.
And I just wanted to say to Diane. Thank you so much for being with us, kiddo.
Thank you.
And thank Dick, because you know he's a very smart man, and he needs to know that. You know, we appreciate all the input. Diane and I go way back, and she's been a wonderful supporter and a friend . Since she was a little girl, she was a medium, and so it's good that we have. And also now, Ned is working on being a medium, or is a medium, and wants to maybe do some readings at the end of the show. So we'll work on that, Ned.
Okay.
And Joseph, Diane Goebel texted me and said that she has been listening for the last half hour, but she wasn't able to get her voice heard, so perhaps she can join us on the next show.
That's great. Sure, of course. I'm sorry, Diane. I don't know what happened, but anyway, Diane's story is wonderful. She died of something that she teaches, which is called conscious living, conscious dying. And that's a great workshop that she does. Also, Diane, just a little scenario about her. She was on a film crew doing the movie, her and her husband, called Deliverance. You guys remember that movie where they had rapids and they went down the rapids.
Yeah, Burt Reynolds started that movie.
Yes, exactly. And so her and her husband took a break and went down the rapids. And I'm if I remember correctly, it's been a while since we talked about this, but I thought she took separate rafts, and her raft turned over and trapped her, and she died underwater. And so her husband, who couldn't swim, was ready to jump into the water, and she ends up next to him. And she says, no, and she put her hand through him, and she went, shit, I'm dead. She didn't know she was dead. And then she talks about that whole story, which is wonderful. She's we've been friends for over 20 years, so she's pretty special to me. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, I'm sure she'll elaborate on this the last time we talk to her. So I just want to say, everybody, Ned, thank you so much for being here, buddy.
I loved it. And next time or in the future, I'm interested.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, you've got a lot to say, and I'm so happy that there's so much we can learn from each other here. And I can say I'm so blessed to be able to share this on the day of the Lord rose from the dead. It's pretty special to me. And so thank you all so much for being here. And it's peace on earth, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. Yeah. And thank you.
All right. Take care,
everyone. Okay, I guess we'll end it then. Thank you again, guys, and we'll talk soon.
All right.
Thanks, Joseph. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.